Magic Magazine fans. The March issue for 2011 is here and ready to go, and we've got an extra special treat this month. We have an interview with Eugene Berger. So stay tuned and check out the interview. Hope you enjoy it. Thanks for listening.
Well, it's nice to be here, everyone.
Yes, and I'm sure they feel the same way. Well, the first thing I wanted to know is if there's any question. You get a lot of questions over the years, and you're kind of known for your often your deep thoughts or your philosophical answers. And so I'm wondering if there's a question you get that you just hate.
No, I can't think of one.
So does that go back to the whole there's no such thing as a dumb question, or are you just trying to be polite?
No, I don't. I've never found a question I hate.
Cool. Okay. Well, a friend of mine, Brad Gordon, he told me to throw this one at you, see how you'd respond. And the question was, tell us something we don't know.
That we're all asleep.
Interesting. In a Matrix-style sleep? And I don't mean a coin Matrix, I mean a Keanu Reeves Matrix.
Well, the Hindus say that the world is Maya, magic, illusion, Leela dance, it's play. And that's a very different kind of a world picture than we grow up with in the West, where it's the universe is some kind of created artifact. There it's a dance. That might be, and that dance is also magic, as the word Maya means magic.
See, there you go. That's that deep philosophical answer I was talking about.
I apologize.
Oh, not at all. No, no, no. I love it. It's great.
You see, we got into the secret question, surprise question.
Yeah, the two main secret questions were, what questions do you hate? Which I guess turned out to not be that much of a curveball.
God, I hated it.
Yeah, that's right.
Because I'm willing to say I don't know.
Yeah.
I haven't thought about it.
That's true.
Yeah.
As opposed to just talking about something I don't have any thoughts about.
Right. Well, then the other trick question was the tell us something we don't know. And when Brad told me to ask that question, I said, about Eugene or about what? And he said, no, just leave it at that. Tell us something we don't know. And you came up with a great answer. We're all asleep. I like it.
Okay, onward and upward.
Well, I have some of the readings of yours that I've read and some of the videos I've seen you on. You've talked about some of your mentors. At this stage, you're obviously more of a mentor than a student, I think. You probably view yourself as a student more, but what would you ask your mentors right now if you had this all-knowing guru of magic? What would you want to know?
Well, my biggest mentor was Don Alice when I was a kid.
Right.
Because he was on television, which gave him a reality far beyond any other magician I knew. And the weird thing, Jeff, is that I know the answer he would give to whatever question I would ask him. Because it was always the same answer. And it was only years later that I understood the profundity of his answer. You know, I was just, you know, kind of super hyped up kid, overweight, being given Dexamil, which was, you know, Dexedrine and a downer. Right.
Yeah.
I'm 16 years old, and that's my medicine. So I'm this speedy little kid just absorbed in magic, and I see Don Allen every other Friday, usually. And I have all these questions for him, and his answer is always the same. Watch their faces. Their faces will tell you everything you need to know. And that's what he would land me. So when you say, what do I think my mentor would say now, he'd probably say the same thing.
Yeah, that's right.
Watch their faces.
Excellent.
That was wonderful advice, because it meant more than just watch their faces. Are they interested or are they looking at their watches? But it also meant making some kind of human contact in this little 10-minute show I'm doing as a stand-up performer at a AT&T cocktail party. So, you know, the idea is to give, is really to give people an experience that they'll talk about, hopefully, and perhaps even in some mild way cherish. So that's really going for it. You know, if I had a trick that would make people cry all the time, I would be the happiest person.
You know, I actually get what you're saying. Yeah.
Oh, that's just being honest.
Yeah. Well, and, you know,
it wasn't maudlin. That's the whole thing. It can't be maudlin. Or you can't look like you're being manipulated, even
right.
if you are, of course.
Yeah.
Because we're having this conversation in advance.
Well, you know, and I've heard, I think it was Michael Amar talked about one time, when he saw himself on a television performance and all he saw was the top of his head because he was too busy looking down at his hands and not paying attention, not paying attention to the audience, not connecting with them. You don't want your audience to remember the top of your head. You want them to remember Eugene or Jeff or whoever. And so there's even a physical aspect to that advice. It's very clever.
Well, the same thing happened to me. You know, the first TV show I did outside of America was the Paul Daniel show back in 1986, maybe. It was a live Halloween show without a delay. So whatever you said, everybody heard.
Oh, crap.
right, so you do want to say, oh, crap. and so I get the tape of this show, and I watch it, and I'm just like falling apart. I didn't ever look at the camera. I'm playing it to the four people at the table like I would do in reality. And then I realized the camera is a person, Eugene. It's the Queen of England. Not just any person. So the next year when I was fortunate enough to go back again and do this thing and the next Halloween party, my camera work was so much better. But how did I learn that? I learned that by suffering.
Yeah.
And by looking at what I had done and saying, oh my God, what have you done? Or what have you not done?
Yeah.
And that's painful. And yet that's the way we grow. You know, there was this wonderful comment made by Lily Tomlin that I read recently, which was, the road to success is always under construction.
Interesting. Yeah, I like that. Well, you know, one of the things, I actually asked a lot of my readers to, my magazine readers to submit some questions, and I got a few of those. Okay, yeah, so this one, Stephen Bagienski, I believe is how you would pronounce this name. And a lot of the questions they are centered around kind of the state of magic, and there's some interesting ones. You know, these days, TV, movies, internet, those kind of things, you know, the media we experience today is so amazing and powerful. And the question, this particular question is, how can we get magic to that same level of power? There seems to be sort of a stereotype of magicians still that we can't seem to escape from.
Well, wait a minute. The question presumes a category mistake. It's like comparing Cadillacs to oranges. You can't compare magic to TV. I mean, you can compare magic to plate spinning, ventriloquism, tightrope walking, but TV is a medium. The internet is a medium. And so if nothing, I mean, there's nothing that says, you know, you're comparing an act to a venue, and that doesn't work, because then magic is always a failure. But when you look at magic and compared to all the different variety acts I just mentioned, magic's doing pretty well.
Now, I wonder if maybe he meant TV shows, that form of entertainment versus...
Well, magic is good on TV and it's not good on TV, you know. Lance Burton said years ago in, I think, a Genie interview that the reason he did the specials was to get people to come to the theater, whereas most of us think of a TV special as the end of our, you know, career as the fabulous, the pinnacle. But, you know, for him it was just, no, it was just, it was something very different.
Interesting, yeah, that's a good point. Well, our next question, I believe you probably have heard of this guy, Jeff Williams.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he is wondering, if you could change anything about the current state of magic, what would you change and why?
Well, I think that what I tell my students in Chicago and what I tell the students in Las Vegas too is you've got to begin to manage your time on the Internet. The Internet is a great boon and it's a great danger at the same time. It doesn't come with a user's guide.
That's so true.
You don't, and you don't know who you're talking to in many cases, particularly in chat rooms.
Yeah.
So the person who's been into magic for a month has the same authority as Jeff McBride.
Yeah, that's a scary thought.
You know, that's a difference as,
yeah,
as the person who's being talked to or preached to or whatever. So I think what I tell my students is you've got to not get off the Internet, certainly, but you've got to learn to manage your time because being online is magic in the head. It's not magic in fact. It's not like practicing and rehearsing. No, it's just gathering more knowledge. No, in terms of driving a car or playing the piano, reading a book about it is a good idea maybe. It tells you where to put the key and what the brakes are and all this stuff. But it's not reading the book isn't a substitute for getting behind the car and driving.
Right.
So you have all these people on the Internet that are authorities, but they're only authorities on theories.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them have never performed. So here you are, you know, it's kind of like Alice in Wonderland on one level.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's a kind of predictive novel that we didn't quite understand until the modern period, you know. but here we are lost in this technological wonder. So one of the things you have to do is understand that in terms of growing as a magician, a little video camera is of greater value than being online talking to people. So what would I change about magic? I would hope that magicians would spend more time practicing and rehearsing and less time online.
Excellent. Yeah. In fact, I wrote an article about that in the magazine. I'm going to have to link to it from this interview to remind people of that. That's a very good point. Here's an interesting, this is my question, actually, one of my own. I recently saw an old video of you doing the gypsy thread, and you had the vampire patter that you used to do where you bite the thread rather than burning it. And in the presentation, you actually lit the candle still, and you still performed it with that as your sort of scenery. In the explanation, you talked about how somebody had suggested to you that you should burn the thread instead of biting it, but that you didn't like that idea. And so now, obviously, that is how you perform it. You've completely changed the routine, and you burn the thread. I'm just kind of curious if you had any commentary on that, on how, why you changed, what changed your mind, and that kind of thing.
Well, for years, when I would perform this for magicians, they would say, well, how do you bite the thread when I was doing the vampire routine? And I would say, well, you just bite it. And then at one point, I had like $2,500 worth of dental work done. And that place in my mouth where I bit the thread wasn't there anymore.
Oh, jeez.
And I suddenly understood the depth of their question, which I had misunderstood all those years.
Interesting. Oh.
So now I don't perform the trick at all for about a year. And then I kind of came back to it and said, wait a minute, this is one of your favorite tricks. You have to put this together, my friend. And then on a Saturday afternoon, it just fell into place. It was one of those scripts that just virtually wrote itself, almost as if I were channeling somebody, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it hardly had any changes after it was done, the Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva thing. It just was a script that kind of wrote itself. But it wrote itself after, you know, 40 years of studying Asian philosophy.
Right.
It didn't just fall into place.
I just don't have that kind of time, Eugene.
You know, I understood the metaphor because I knew the metaphor. And I went, burning thread, creation, destruction, restoration of the universe. Hindu cycle. Perfect match. Now let's burn it. That makes even more sense now because it's in a dance of fire. When I did it at the hotel in Atlantic City with Jeff, the crew for the first week thought I was saying Shiva did the $10 dance.
Oops. That's a whole different show.
Not the Tandava dance. And I said, when I discovered this, I said, no, guys, Shiva don't do no Tandava dance.
Jeez. That's funny.
It doesn't work that way.
That's funny. You probably wouldn't go back if you didn't have the dental. Let's say you could reverse time and have your choice between the biting and the new presentation. I'm assuming you'd stick with the current one.
Yeah, because I don't even remember the old one.
It's on your video.
Is it on the Joe Stevens video?
Yes, it is actually. Yep, that old one.
My thing with books and videos, when they first come out, I watch them or I read them. And then I put them on the shelf and I never read them again. And then people ask me, like, what book is such and such in? And I genuinely don't know. And they think probably I'm putting them on in some way, but I really don't know because I really don't read this stuff. I did reread Magic and Meaning when we got the idea of doing a second edition as opposed to a second printing. But typically I don't read these.
Speaking of that book, I just read that recently. I never read the original. I just read the new one and gave it a glowing review on my site, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
All right, so here's another interesting one. Friend Brad Gordon again wondering, what tricks never made it into your repertoire that you like? There's plenty of stuff that you won't do because it's not your thing or whatever, but something you like but you couldn't put it into your repertoire for one reason or another.
I think one trick like that would be the Blue Phantom.
What's that? I'm not familiar with that.
The Blue Phantom is where you have a stack of checkers, and six of them are yellow and one of them is blue. And the checkers are maybe an inch thick and 3 inches in diameter. And they have holes in the center. And so there is a rod coming out of a little stand.
Okay.
And the checkers are dropped on the rod so that the blue checker is on top. Then you have a tube that is enclosed at the top, and you show it empty, and you cover the stack of checkers. And when you lift the tube, the blue checker is now in the middle, and you lift all the checkers above it and show that they're separate. And now you put the tube back on again, and when you lift it the next time, the blue checker is all the way at the bottom. And at this point, you can lift every checker above it and show that it's empty and drop it onto the blue checker. And then you cover it again. It goes up to the middle again and then back to the top, and you take them all off and you're done. And Johnny Platt, when he did this in Chicago, he had the idea of tying a scarf around the tube, a blue scarf. And you would start with the scarf at the top of the tube, and then after then you would cover the stack for the first time and slide the blue silk down to the center. And then when he would lift it, the blue checker would be in the center. And then he would cover it and slide it down to the bottom. And now he would lift it and the blue checker would be at the bottom. Get the idea?
Right.
So that's a trick I always wanted to do, but I never did. I had one when I was a kid, a Blue Phantom, an early Owen one.
So what kept it out? It's not very portable, obviously. Probably couldn't do that in a Sterling, which is your venue mostly, I think.
Almost exclusively.
Yeah.
And if not, it's like the show after dinner. It's sort of like a Magic Castle close-up room show with a table and two people up to help me and the rest of the audience, kind of in the living room. you know, watching the show, and nothing's done on the table. Everything is done up in the air.
Right.
Yeah, most of my work is that kind of thing. And you know, I don't want to start checking luggage. I made a list of criteria that what would it take for something to get into my show now, at this point in my life, where I have the luxury of a pretty strong repertoire, and certainly I don't need any, I certainly don't need any more tricks for my public performing, you know. I can still do just the same old set forever and ever with that, because I'm changing audiences constantly. And when I go back to places, they really want me to do what they saw last year. They want me to do new stuff.
Yeah, I love that.
You know, I mean, we hired you to do those hats. Okay. And the yellow walls. Oh, please don't make me do this. But that's a good thing, I think, for people to do, is to ask yourself, what will it take for something to enter your repertoire now? And then one of the things is it has to fit in my pockets. I can't require a table. The action must be up by my face and not down by my crotch.
Yeah.
And, you know, does it require a reset? Do I need a table to do it? Do I have to check luggage to do this trick? Or can I still get by with carry-on? Nothing's better than leaving the airplane and going directly to a taxi, not going to baggage at all, except there's a walk-through. And then, of course, there's the biggest question, which is, does this trick call to me? Because if it doesn't call to me, there's no point in working on it. Tricks have to call to us, and that means we have to be receptive to receiving these calls.
You know, that's a great segue into what could maybe be our final question. We're coming up in about a half an hour. I know you've talked about this before, that you, when people say, why'd you become a magician, you talk about what you feel sort of almost like a priest who was called to the service, called to the ministry, that you kind of were called as a magician. So my question is, what, and this, by the way, is actually by Kevin McDade. He's one of my subscribers. Beyond what made you want to become a magician, but why do you feel that you're called? How do you know that you're called? How do you know that?
Well, I think when someone receives a call, it just happens. And it's not necessarily subject to a lot of analytical speculation. When I first saw the thread trick done, I'm 16 years old, and there was something, I just want to do that. When I was in second grade, I was in the second row of the balcony at the Oriental Theater in Chicago watching Jack Gwen do the stage show between the movies. And right then and there, I knew that I was supposed to be a magician. I knew it. And then, of course, I went to college and graduate school, and they convinced me I should do something worthwhile with my life.
Yeah, I don't want to be a magician.
And so I've been worthwhile for all those years, and then I had this revelation where I was living with some really good supportive friends who kept saying, quit your job, and I just say, oh, you guys are nuts. But then I realized that if you're not following your own dreams, you're following other people's dreams. And my dream was always to be a magician, and even though I was 39 years old or whatever at that time, I just quit my job and did it. And of course, that was a stupid thing to do. As I've said many times, you know, there's a smart way and a dumb way to become a professional magician. The smart way is with the way my friend Ross Johnson did it. Ross was a teacher with all those benefits, and he didn't want to give up. And yet suddenly he had all this work as a mentalist and just had to quit his job because he was just doing too much work as a mentalist for much more money per minute.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Right? Then there was the dumb way to quit, become a magician, which is what I did. That was to say, you quit your job with no prospects at all. and then just go into terror. And in my case, you just get really lucky. The cosmos smiles down on you. And even though you were completely stupid in what you did, it suddenly begins working out.
Well, I think there's something to the to be said about the just, you know, in with all feet, with both feet, where you kind of, you have to do it or else you're not going to eat. You know, you're right, that maybe that is the dumb way, maybe not. It might be just the way to motivate, you know, fear motivation rather than something else.
See, what a lot of parents don't understand, you know, Jeff McBride and I have been doing the Lindsperton Teen Weekend for, I think, almost 10 years now, maybe 10 years. That starts off before the World Magic Seminar. And one of the things a lot of the parents don't quite get, I think, is that people don't go into the arts for money.
So true.
They didn't go into the arts to become a millionaire or to become successful with a big house. They went into painting or playing the piano or singing or being a magician because something inside them was calling them to do this. And they were responding to this inner calling that is not, that I couldn't explain other than saying, you know, years ago, when I was just getting to know Lindsperton, I said to him, do you feel you were called to be a magician? And he said, oh, yes. You know, when I was a kid, I thought my calling was to be a minister. And then when I was 16, it changed. And I could understand exactly what he was talking about.
Yeah.
Because I felt that way, too. And I think that, that we have to, you know, we're always in a state of mind where we're trying to do, accomplish. I think it's success in something like magic, you also have to be in a receptive state of mind periodically, a listening state of mind, a state of mind that's open, and so that you can hear the things that are calling to you. And I think that's where we probably should leave this, you know, that the most important thing of all is to be open and to be listening. Because if there is a trick that's going to call to you, as long as your skull is filled with chatter, you may not even hear it. Trapped into doing tricks that other people tell you you should do. And that's just, for me, walking in the quicksand. No, the trick, first of all, has to call to me. And if it doesn't, I'm not going to invest the time into it.
You know, what I'm hearing is when you're saying being open, and that there's even a specific thing to be open to, which is who you are. Who am I as a performer that this trick speaks to me, who I am, and being less open to being somebody else. You're not Don Allen. He's your mentor, but you're Eugene Berger.
And I don't want there to be nothing of Don Allen in me. I still want there to be some Don Allen in me, but
yeah.
I don't want to be him anymore. When I was 16, I could really do Don Allen family parties. You know, I knew the tricks, the lines, the pacing. So I just kind of just pretended I was Don Allen. and you know, magicians, kids pretend that they're Jeff McBride. They pretend that they're Lance. You know, they pretend that they're Chris Angel. And that's beautiful and pathetic.
I guess I should stop growing my beard out then.
For diet.
Yeah. Oh, it's gray.
Go for diet.
Yeah, that's funny.
Silver or gold.
All right. Well, I appreciate your time. I know you're a busy, busy guy, and so... You're adding, you're taking my magazine up a little notch by doing this interview.
I really talking with you, and thank you for having me.
Well, that's it, gang. Thanks for listening. Make sure you check out Eugene Berger's website, magicbeard.com, and check out his Growing in the Art of Magic downloads that he has on his site as well. And also, I just recently read his book, Magic and Meaning, the extended edition. I've written a review about it here on the site. There's a link to it on the article page that you're viewing right now. So take a look at that, and thanks again for listening, and as always, thanks for being a fan of Stone Cold Magic Magazine. See you next time.